This is Claire Lehman, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 10th of June 2011. Claire Lehman, Part 1.
So my name is Dr. Claire Lehman, and my date of birth is the 21st of February 1980, and my place of birth, as my friends like to call it, is Amazingstoke, but is actually Basingstoke in Hampshire.
What sort of education did you have, Claire?
I went to primary school in Whitewater, in Rotherwick, in a little village in Hampshire. And then I went to a state school in Basingstoke called Bishop Challoner, which is a Catholic school. And then I went to a sixth form college in Alton, also in Hampshire. And then up to university. To study medicine at Corpus Christi College in Oxford. Sounds like the start of university challenge.
Your start of a 10. Is there a history of medicine in the family?
Don't think so. I think very distantly there was a great uncle who was a surgeon in Italy, but a great great uncle many moons ago. So I don't know.
So what drew you to a medical career?
When I was doing my GCSEs and my A-levels, I've always been interested in science. And the results came back quite, my first kind of grades for GCSEs and predicted grades for A-levels were quite good. And I thought about applying for biochemistry. And then I was thinking about it and thought, well, actually, it'd be quite nice to know what the diseases I'd be treating if I did biochemistry. So I'll apply for medicine, and if I get in, I'll do that. And if I don't gain a place, I shall apply through clearing and go to do biochemistry somewhere. So it was rather divine intervention that I ended up doing medicine, really.
And did you actually practice as a GP or a doctor? What did you choose to do when you finished university?
So I decided to practice as a GP. So I had a brief time, 6 months in Sweden after I did my first house officer jobs, and studied a bit of public health there, and then decided to go into GP training. And I was studying that, working as a GP rather, and doing all the training for it in Salisbury, down in Wiltshire, and was working in the hospital jobs there, doing A&E and paediatrics and obs and gynae and some psychiatry. And then I did my GP registrar year, so that's the final year of GP training in Fordingbridge, so back to Hampshire. And I had a two-month hiatus between my hospital jobs and general practice, and I went to India for a couple of months as an expedition doctor, so with Raleigh International, so slightly varied career.
What was your first awareness of a place called the Antarctic?
I remember being in the library at the medical school in Oxford, and in my final year, we were planning our electives, and there's a big tome of a book called the Elective Planning Book, I can't remember the actual title, but there was also a couple of copies of the BMJ beside it, and I was flicking through, and there was an article about a doctor who'd just returned from the Antarctic, and I just was absolutely captivated. I love freezing cold places, and as it was, I was already thinking about applying for an elective in Newfoundland in Canada during the winter. And actually emailed my now boss, Pete Marquis, as a medical student, saying, I don't suppose you take elective students, but I'm just curious about the job. And he said, no, you're right, we don't take elective students. But this is kind of a bit more about the job. And I always had that in my mind subsequently when I was pursuing my career as a professional. So
at what point in your life was that? Did that take place at first?
The first awareness of it was when I was in 2003 or 2004. So just actually before I'd qualified as a doctor. Mm. And then it was in 2009.
So you kind of squirrel that away, did you?
Yeah. So 2008 I applied. So it was about 5 years after the initial awareness of it, I actually applied. So it's hard to imagine. They wouldn't have, looking back at the girl reading a journal in the medical school at university as a student, it's hard to imagine that I've now, within that time, actually gone and done the jobs.
Come back.
Yeah, and survived.
So what was it that sparked off the desire to apply formally to BAS? In 2008?
Well, I was coming towards the end of my GP training, and I've always had always with the idea of Antarctica in the background. I'd always mentioned it to various friends, and wanting to get involved in expedition medicine, primarily with Antarctica in mind. And so it was coming to the end of my training, and Googled to find out when the application was out. I was looking for the previous year's application, because I thought it was in October. And was preparing in advance. It was about August, September time. And actually, bizarrely, that year, the adverts were earlier. So I was really lucky that I did it at that time. And happened to find the advert and applied for that. I didn't want to get... I wanted to give Antarctica a go. There was no way I could not apply for it.
So you got an interview, I guess. What do you remember of the interview?
Yeah, it was a funny day. I remember the morning, it was actually Halloween, so 31st of October, and I was having a Halloween party that evening in Salisbury. So the morning, the interview itself down in Plymouth, the morning before the interview, I was carving pumpkins at home in my house in Salisbury for a party that evening I had planned. Jumped on the train, it was snowing, so I didn't know whether I'd get there on time. Made it to Plymouth, had my interview, and there were about six people in the interview room, and went on for about an hour and chatting about various things and asking questions. And Anne Hicks was there, who's the now clinical lead of BASMU, and Pete Marquis, who's the manager of it, who's also a former FID at Rothera, and some members of staff from BAS as well. And just remember being myself and answering the questions as they were directed, and then meeting the girls, Sue and Ali, upstairs after two of the secretaries for BASMU, and jumping on the train afterwards. And I think somewhere between Exeter and Plymouth, receiving a phone call on my mobile, I think I was the last interview of the day, from Anne Hicks telling me to have my passport ready and that I was going to Antarctica and I was going to Rothera. So there was a girl weeping with delight on a Southwest train. And I think the people beside me thought it was slightly unusual, and then opening some champagne when we got home and having a very good Halloween party.
So you knew within hours?
Yeah.
What do you recall of the interview itself? Do you remember, was it rigorous, would you say?
Yeah, it was. I mean, they've got to ascertain that you've got a sane person in front of you who's got an awareness of what the job entails, and unusually for an interview, we were asked, you know, normally in standard interview practice, you wouldn't ask about personal relationships or family so much, but they asked, you know, have you thought about what would happen if you know, a first-degree relative were to become poorly whilst you're away? And, you know, was I in a relationship that would jeopardise me going? Or and so, which you don't necessarily have to answer, but I answered as best I could.
Hmm.
And yeah, I think even after the initial interview, I don't think it was until we were actually down there you fully appreciate some of the ramifications of being away in Antarctica for 18 months. But I was very fortunate. My family have stayed very well while I've been away. And yeah, I've been lucky.
Do you think you were being sussed out psychologically?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. There was, completely forgotten his name, the head of HR at the time. He's subsequently retired, but he's got many years' experience within BAS. And he's very hot on people. So BAS don't use psychometric testing formally like other countries do. And, yeah, being, you know, not pushed or kind of assessed for, well, I suppose, just normal conversation, but they're obviously, you know, you've got two people watching you, a couple of people asking questions, two other people writing notes. It's quite intense, but they need to make sure they get the right person for the job, and hopefully I please them. So
there was no formal psychometric testing, no. It was just a seat of the pants stuff, which is the way BAS has always done it over the decades. You probably heard about a guy called Bill Sloman, who was the guy who did it for several decades.
Yes.
Around the interviews.
Yes, no, it was. I'm trying to remember his name. I can't remember.
Doesn't matter. No. It'll come later on. So what did he have to do between getting that phone call and catching that plane?
Well, the job was due to start in April of 2009, so 6 months later, effectively. And so I had to finish my GP training in the meantime, finish my exams, gain my specialist certificate.
Was that a condition of getting the job?
No, not at all, just for my own professional, you know, professional progression. And then we have 6 months training in Plymouth before we go away, where we're supernumerary and having training bespoke to our needs. So there were four doctors, myself included, one going to Halley, one going to South Georgia, and one going on the JCR. And the three of us, the Halley doctor has done surgery and anaesthetics, so he had to gain sort of more general practice experience, and the three other of us were all girls, were all GPs, so had to gain more experience in anaesthetics and surgery. So doing that, we also did courses in radiology, so learning how to take x-rays and develop them, physiotherapy, dentistry, basic surgical skills, did some ophthalmology, basic life support, advanced life support, advanced life support and trauma. Quite a few courses, basically. Mm. It was a quite busy 6 months before going away.
So actually, as a doctor, you started much longer, much earlier than most of the other FIDs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you say Plymouth, what do you mean?
At Derriford Hospital.
So Derriford.
Derriford, yeah. It's where the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit is based, largely operating from the A&E unit there, where we have 24-hour support all the time we're out in the field. And so we were based from the hospital and spent time within Dereford Hospital itself and also sort of specialist hospitals close by, for example, like the Eye Hospital, having our training there. So it was quite a busy 6 months.
Before I forget to ask the question, did you ever have to ring them up as whilst you were... You did?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that without naming names?
I've had to contact them quite a bit when I was away. Often I contacted Dereford or Bearsmoor just, you know, for basic kind of touching base and checking things are all right. But in acute situations, yeah, I've had to phone up Dereford and speak to them directly. They have a special phone in the A&E department called the Bat phone, which is the Antarctic phone. So when that one rings, it's just from us. And we generally speak to the senior doctor on the shop floor, as we call it, so out treating patients in A&E. I've always had a very good response and very good support from them. So sometimes you've had to contact specialist doctors via them and then email photos back and forth. So taking digital photographs, putting them on the computer, emailing them, then receiving emails back. We don't have it advanced enough yet to use Skype directly because the internet bandwidth isn't great enough. But the photographs and chatting works well over the telephone. So, and taking photos of x-rays and things like that. We didn't have digital x-rays where we are. It's a bit old school. Old school works well in Antarctica.
Can you imagine doing all that by Morse code?
No, I mean, it would... exactly. It would be a bit of a nightmare.
I'm aware of your oaths, so I don't know how much you can tell me about. Can you give me an example of a situation that you had to deal with, which doesn't necessarily identify anybody?
Somebody who managed to hurt their foot and basically it was swollen, could have been a fracture, so having to take a photo of that. It wasn't very clear whether it was a fracture or not. So contacting Bearsmoor, emailing the actual x-ray across and letting them know and finding out and then sort of working out what to do next.
So you could take an x-ray at Rotherham, but you couldn't diagnose...
Oh, I can if it's an obvious thing, but sometimes you might need to...
Second opinion.
Yeah. Sometimes there can be a delay between presentation and actual incident happening, which clouds the muddies the waters somewhat. Yeah. And definitely for dental things, I was often having to take x-rays, and sometimes they're more difficult to interpret. And so we'd often email the dentists, which is sort of a separate part of Bearsmoor as well, with dental x-rays to see what they thought of those.
So did you find yourself doing more GP work than you imagined or less, because you're surrounded by young fit people, weren't you, really?
Yeah, I actually had, if anything, I ended up doing more things more akin to normal general practice than I thought I would do, because Bass is quite accepting of older people or people with other disabilities, or not disabilities but illnesses, that some other countries may not, because we've got the infrastructure to deal with it. And so there were some people coming down who had blood pressure problems, for example, or cholesterol, or looking at other things. And also as a young fit population, there are still things that people need. For example, you know, young women seeking contraception, or young guys with questions about sexual health. So all that sort of standard part of general practice still happens regardless of age. And it was nice to have sort of the mix of other things as well, for example, blood pressure, to kind of keep your awareness going, really, of those things, so you don't forget about them when you come back, which is good.
That's a good point. Let's go back to Plymouth then.
Yeah.
And you were doing this it seemed to be like a very intensive course. Was there at any point whilst you were at Plymouth, did you have any doubts about your ability to cope with any of this?
I think at the time, it's a bit difficult. I think you've got to. I applied myself well to all of the courses and passed them, and my consultants were happy with the progress. So I'm somebody who always, I'm probably too modest and to an extent always think I need to know more. And sometimes I can come across as somebody who's not, you know, so I'd be kind of seeking assurance from my consultants that I was doing as I should be doing, possibly slightly more than some people who are kind of rather gung-ho and yes, I'm definitely doing that always right. And I think I've got better at being more confident since being away. You have to be when you're the only doctor around for a few thousand miles. And also because I am capable of doing it. So that's been a useful thing.
So were you at any time kind of putting up a front when you were down south? This kind of the impression of being a confident... Because, I mean, part of one of the requirements of a GP is to look and feel confident, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the patient has confidence in you.
No, I would never say I put in a front because I don't... I don't that's not very me. I behave professionally. Yeah. I wouldn't put on a front. And I think it's different for each individual doctor. But personally, if I don't know something, I'd rather say to the patient, well, that's actually something I'm not particularly familiar with. Because patients often present with things that you may not be particularly familiar with. They may present with the most rarest disease they've picked up in Guatemala, for example. And I'm not a specialist on Guatemalan skin diseases, for example. I'd have to read up on it. But I'd rather say to the patient, well, it's all absolutely fine at the moment. There's nothing really worrying me right now. But this is something I need to kind of get more au fait with. How about you come back tomorrow and we'll have another look at it then? Which gives me time to then speak to the people who are authorities on rare diseases and things like that, to then to actually confer with them. So it's not I never put on a front because that's not me and it's not how I practice. But I would, if I didn't know something, I would, convey that and deal with it accordingly and appropriately.
Question didn't quite come out as I intended. I hope
that's okay. That. No, it's fine.
In a village like Durrington, the doctor and the vicar are significant individuals, aren't they? They're kind of respected members of the community.
Yeah.
Was that repeated in Rotherhithe? Did you find that being the doctor on base, you were?
No, you're more ridiculed rather than anything
else.
Are you? Yeah,
tell
absolutely.
Me about that.
Well, because of confidentiality, quite often people aren't aware that you're seeing anybody at all, and that's how it should be, to be honest. I wouldn't want to know, in a small community, you don't want people finding out things inadvertently, and I go to great lengths to avoid that. So consequently, people often think, oh, the doctor's doing nothing. And there's this general joke that the doctor's, never doing anything and is always just sitting around twiddling their fingers, which is largely true, a joke. We have a lot to do, and the other thing is, because back here, and since I've come back this last fortnight, I've been back to general practice, seeing 40 patients a day. In Rotherhithe, I was seeing maximum 40 patients a month and informal consultations. And so the volume of patients you see keeps you more abreast of things, wherein you're not doing that. You've got to make a real vested in effort to make sure that you're compensating for that lack of experience you're gaining with patients some other way, so you don't lose out on your skills and your knowledge. So quite a lot of the time when I wasn't seeing patients, when I wasn't doing other jobs that I had to do on base, I was addressing those needs. So reading around issues, reading papers, and with the internet, there are sort of learning modules you can do online and things like that. So it's called continuing professional development, is the technical term.
You had to make a particular effort to do that.
Yes,
whilst you're away.
Which some people can see as you just fiddling around on the internet, because people can misperceive. You think, oh yes, they're just on Facebook or some checking their emails. Like, no, actually, I'm learning about prostate problems or blood pressure, diabetes. I haven't seen so much of that down here recently. So which is hard to convey to people sometimes.
Okay. Let's go back to Plymouth then.
Yeah.
And you'd done your course at Plymouth, and the next step was to go to Cambridge to Girton College for the famous conference.
Yeah.
Tell me about that experience.
It was brilliant. I think the weekend before conference I'd actually been to a festival in the Isle of Wight. So I'd had a really lovely weekend, glorious weather with my friends from university, and arrived to conference. And just fortunately, I'd met the base commander, John Withers, before, and also the winter base commander, Dickie Hall. So I had met a couple of people at Cambridge already, so a few familiar faces, and just started meeting the people I was going to be going away with. And it was beautiful weather and a really dynamic bunch of people. It was a really good, fun week. Really enjoyed it. I met Ashley, who's now the boatwoman at KP. She came down to Rotherhithe initially with me. So we made some really good firm friends. We had a bit of a swimming group in the morning going on. Ian Dunn and Ashley and myself. There was a little pool at Girton College, so we used to go in the morning before lectures started. So it was. I really enjoyed the week.
What did you make of the intellectual input of that course, apart from the social side of things, which is equally important? But those three... Well, it was more than 3 days, wasn't
it?
Yeah. It was
it's almost over a week. It was almost a week. There's a lot to take in, and it's because you're being sort of taught in all manner of different aspects of Antarctic living. But I think it's a great idea because, even with it, you kind of arrive and sometimes like, whoa, it's all very different. But at least you've got an awareness of that before you arrive and step off the plane. Oh yes, I know I'm going to be able to go in these areas, or, there's a fireboard or things like that, the kind of practical aspects of life. Looking back on it, to be honest, the week went by in such a blur, I think, because you're just meeting people the whole time and going from one workshop on, relationships, or at the end of the week we were teaching first aid as well with a medical course. So it was just a real busy week of learning about what Bass does in Antarctica, what the different bases are like.
What sort of impression did you get of Bass at that point? I mean, I'm thinking particularly the kind of historical perspective, because I think David Walton gave quite a moving talk about the origins of FIDS.
Yeah, I mean, that was really moving because it just puts it all into perspective and you realise you're taking part in this extraordinary institution and this part of history that you're actually taking part in. And not so very few people do actually get to go to Antarctica, let alone to winter. And having that put into context just made it feel incredibly special and made me feel very fortunate to be able to do that. I also very much enjoyed Chris Dabrowski, who was one of the artists who went down a few years ago, did a fabulous presentation, which was so funny, on his work, making photo frames out of Nansen sledges. Making a Nansen sledge out of a photo frame. But yeah, there were sort of fun aspects of it as well. But the historical perspective certainly made it seem more special.
Make a mental note, talk to you about him when we finish.
Okay.
And then you were off to Derbyshire to do the physical...
Yes.
Cliff rescue and crevasse rescue training.
Yeah.
That's the last time I saw you.
Yes, that was, wasn't it? Gosh, I was petrified myself going off a crevasse, off the cliff. I'm not a... Before I went away, I'd never really played around with ropes and harnesses off cliff faces in high winds, or in any winds at all, in fact. So that was a baptism of fire, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I'm really glad we did that before we went down onto a completely alien environment of ice and snow, because it was very different.
Did you have to use anything you picked up on that field trip?
Yeah. I mean, certainly the kind of getting familiar with putting on the harnesses and roping up. I did lots of climbing and walking and skiing over crevasse terrain and on glaciers. So you've got to be ready prepared for how to do those basic simple things like tying various knots. And there's a pulley system thing that we have to practice doing for retrieving people from crevasses. Fortunately, we never had to do that, but we also had to kind of revise it during the time we were there, so we were familiar with how to do it if we needed to. And I've had to do an ice axe arrest with someone before as well. So,
yeah.
Although I learnt that when I was down there, but yes. Yeah, I think on our winter trip when we were going, in my first summer, a group of, I think, Ashley, Adam and I were walking up Stalk, one of the hills, mountains near base, and I think Adam slipped below us and his foot went down into a crevasse, and I immediately like crashed to the floor with my ice axe, sort of arrested it, and the others kind of held us above us, so yeah, it was good.
You were all roped up.
Yeah, I think Clive, yeah. Ashley, Adam and I were all roped up, I can't remember how, but yes.
Okay, and then we kind of, the date of departure approaches, and I think in your case it got delayed, didn't it?
Yeah, it got delayed several times. Flights always change, with Bass, everything's always changing, so even if you think you're going tomorrow, you may well not be. That's just by virtue of weather, flights, operational requirements. Which for me worked out well, because it meant I got to have bonfire night in the UK, which I was very glad about. I had a fabulous last few weeks before I went away. I went to a brilliant concert in London, had a lovely time meeting friends in London, going down to Dorset for one last time to go to the beach at Studland, getting to spend a bit more time with my family, seeing autumn properly, going to some friends' 30th birthday parties. I turned 30 when I was away, and the first of my school friends were starting to turn 30, so at least I got to go to a couple of parties before going away. And just really, I was driving around the UK rather frenetically trying to make the most of seeing people before I wouldn't be able to, but I'm really glad I did that.
Who are you leaving behind? Who was important to you?
My mother, my sister, my dad, and then lots of good school friends.
Did you have any parental opposition to your idea of going?
No, not at all. My parents are both very supportive of my sister and I doing exciting things. Just before I'd gone away, my sister was living in Shanghai for 2.5 years and had literally come back the summer before I went. So I think they're quite used to it. And before that, she'd been to Nepal and I've been to India. So I think our parents are quite supportive of us off going off and being adventurous and trying new things.
Good. So how did you get there?
Well, we started off, Ashley and I were travelling together, which is really nice.
Give me Ashley's second name.
Ashley Perrin. So she's, now a boatwoman at KAP. And we kind of forged a friendship from conference when we first met, and that was really nice because then we ended up travelling together.
Is she North American?
Yes, yeah. Although half, he has British passport as well, I think. But And who else with us? Steve Colwell, who's a meteorologist, and Adam Lane, who's a Navy pilot, and Chris Bowden as well, both Navy people going down to work as radio operators. So we're all travelling together. And we started off at Heathrow, and Ashley's parents and mine family, sort of, we all had a joint lunch together in Pret-a-Manger before a rather tearful farewell, as late as possible before the gate was about to close, and then frantically flying on to then Madrid, and then changing to Madrid to fly to Santiago, where we had a 24-hour stay over in Santiago, which is brilliant, having gone from dreary November weather in the UK to sort of 30-degree sunshine, glorious. So we had a very nice time there, sort of soaking up some South American life. And then flying down via Punta Arenas to the Falkland Islands, where we then had about 3 days in the Falklands. So going from glorious sunshine back to weather rather reminiscent of the UK.
What happened in the Falklands? Was that just rest over, or were you actually being kitted out? Or?
No, it was just rest over, waiting for the flights, in terms of they weren't scheduled and the way the flights worked. We had to have a few days there. So we made the most of it and went out on a tour around the Falkland Islands in a sort of 4x4 with a local chap, showing us all the kind of war areas. We went to Goose Green, San Carlos Bay, and had supper in his croft, which was lovely. And so, yeah, and then we ended up, the day came and the weather was good, and we drove up to the airport at Mount Pleasant and boarded our plane to Antarctica. And that's a really unusual experience. The first time you walk out to a plane and carry your own bags on, the bus drives you to the door. It's like, this is the start of something unusual. And it's funny how normal that actually becomes. Where you can just like drive up to a plane and just pop your things in and then you're off, became par for the course. It's slightly unusual to now have to go to an airport and wait around and things. I prefer it the other way. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get you to Rotherhithe there. And I mean, you've seen photographs, you've heard all about it. What was it like in reality?
Oh, it was amazing flying in. I was the winter on board, so I got to go in the front, in the jump seat on for landing. And they were like, oh, it's just there. And I could see it was a beautiful wet day. It was an expanse of white and sea and the occasional iceberg. And I was like, I can't see where this place is. And it's literally just the final bank. And then I saw this dot below us. Oh my gosh, that's it. And everything around it was this massive, huge expanse of grandiose mountains and sea in this tiny little dot, which was going to be my home for 18 months. And as soon as I stepped off the plane, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just perfect. I'm meant to be here. It just felt brilliant. It's a beautiful place, really stunning. And John was there. John Withers was there to welcome us onto the ground, which was lovely. And then kind of a bombardment of, you know, safety briefings and finding where things were, and whereas I was just like, oh my gosh, look, there's penguins and there's icebergs. So still kind of, and even about for a month afterwards, I was still kind of to be honest, until I left, I was still overawed by what surrounded me. It's a unique place.
What did you make of the scale of the place?
I obviously see maps with, you know, a scale on it. It's always difficult to envisage what it's going to be like. I think it was the same size as I was expecting it to be. It's quite a large base spread over quite a reasonable sized area with several individual buildings. And I think that's better to have several buildings. It kind of gives you different environments. You can don't feel like you're just living and working in the same place day in, day out. Whereas, you know, Halley or somewhere further south, there's a need, because the weather's so inclement, to have everything in one building. We're quite fortunate where we are to have it in separate buildings. And I guess there's also merit of having separate buildings. If one goes into flame, you've got other ones in reserve, which is always useful. It just felt like home.
But did it feel like a scientific establishment or a university building or an aircraft hangar? How did it feel?
Well, we had an aircraft hangar and we had a university building. It's hard to imagine. I was going to say, it felt like a professional place to be, but at the same time, it also felt like home. And I guess that's partially because I wintered there and I was, you know, made my room my home for the 18 months I was there. I was lucky I got to keep that room. And it felt familiar. So, and having just been to the surgery where I worked previously today, it felt a similar kind of familiarity about it. But they've got really remarkable facilities down in the Bonner Laboratory. Old Bransfield's looking slightly tired, and I think they're going to redo it. There was hope for a new building to replace it, but it's not going to happen quite yet, I don't think. New Bransfield's an amazing building. It's kind of the building where everybody socialises, eats, so the library is, some visiting offices, and that's only a couple of years old, and it's beautiful, and is a really good kind of welcome to Antarctica for the British Antarctic Survey. So,
what about the doctor's surgery? How was it for you? How did you clear it?
How did I clear it? Well, I cleared it and set to scrubbing things and taking bookshelf books off walls. I think it depends on doctors. Different doctors are different. There's some beautiful little bits of vintage kit. And you've got to be cautious in throwing too much away because actually, quite frankly, the older stuff actually works much better and you don't have the problems with expiry dates and things like that on older bits of kit than you do on new. But if they still work, obviously you don't want to have something that you've got that can work but isn't actually useful. I kind of made it more welcoming. There weren't too many photos on the walls, so I put a few more up. Tried to make it, made it more comfortable. In my surgery in the UK and my general practice, I had my own photos and things on the wall, so made it more like home, so shared that.
Had you been involved in any way in ordering what you would need? So drugs, kit?
No, not for that medicines. Not for that first year. There's a kind of annual every year the doctor during winter orders what's required for the subsequent winter. So the doctor prior to me ordered what would come for me and the doctor prior to him ordered for him. So there's always a time delay and there's a general basic list of things that they always have. And I did actually make a couple of changes when I arrived, because most people going to do the job aren't necessarily always general practitioners. And there are certain things that were missing off the list that I was like, oh, actually, maybe we should get this.
You're adding to the list, were you?
Yeah. I'm just making, some minor things, sort of adding a different kind of contraceptive pill that we didn't have before and things like that.
Mm. Were you able to do that before the weather closed down?
Yes, I was managed to get. In the summer, you can get some things in relatively quickly, within a fortnight if you need it.
So one of the first things then was to work out what was missing.
Yes, and some of it wasn't so much missing.
To broaden the scope.
Yeah. And also sometimes things would expire. We hadn't necessarily anticipated them expiring when they have. So sometimes you get drugs hand carried down by people. Hopefully that's okay to say. via sort of Bass mail, because obviously you don't want to give certain things through the Royal Mail because it might go, take a time delay to get down, whereas people carrying it from Cambridge down seems to work better. So we often had bits coming down, which is quite handy.
So tell me about those first few days, because one part of it was to get used to it. And also, I guess it was a handover period of sorts,
yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, there was. I mean, the first few days was just getting used to being there. Everybody arriving has a certain degree of basic training they've got to do. So I think our second night up there, we camped on the snow in the pyramid tents up at Val's. That was extraordinary. It's sort of using the little stoves and putting the Primus lamps up, tilly lamps. And sleeping on the pea bag system, so your sort of thermarest, sheepskin rug. What else is there? Your sleeping bag, your flame retardant liner, your silk liner. You've got like a bug in a rug. It's really warm. Mm. So yeah, doing that for the first time, that was amazing. So it was like, my gosh, I've just arrived in Antarctica and I'm camping already. It's amazing. So that was brilliant. And then doing some basic training sort of out on the hill, doing ice axe arrest and things like that. As soon as that was finished, then we could get on to doing kind of work-specific handovers. So with the doctor that was there, I had handover probably about 4 to 6 weeks in total. And then there was initial kind of handover, so far that I need to know immediately where all the emergency things were, because there's not much use in having a doctor there if they don't even know where the defibrillator is. So that was pretty early on within the first few days. Just finding sort of the emergency kits and drugs. And then gradually, it was rather ad hoc, but working our way through. It was slightly more structured the second year.
And then that doctor left after a while.
He actually left at last call at the end of the summer. But he went out into the field, I think before Christmas before Christmas he went out. So
you're actually on your own in the base as a base doctor quite early on.
I think it was before Christmas he went out. Yeah. And that did feel different, I have to say. It did feel different. Because that was the first time I've ever been a sole doctor anywhere. I think for anyone that would feel different, I'm speaking to my colleagues today. None of, with a bunch of GPs with 30 years experience each, none of them would fancy doing what I just did. So that's maybe why they end up getting junior doctors. Or, not as senior. But so that was quite interesting. You never know when you're going to get called for doing something either. So it makes life always slightly more interesting.
Well, how was that psychologically for you?
It was quite hard. And I envisaged it probably being difficult. And I think it very much depends on the individual as to how they perceive their role there and how they perceive their role professionally generally, or how they, yeah. So for me, if something were to happen, I'd always want to be able to respond regardless of the situation. So for as far as alcohol's concerned, I didn't ever become tipsy when I'd have a glass of wine with supper, but I didn't want to be able to not respond if something happened when I was the only doctor around. And initially, I think it's, I remember when winter first started, I think maybe it was Matt first went out. I was like, when winter first started, and there was no other doctor for miles around then. And I get to bed sort of running through certain scenarios in my mind, just like, okay, so if this happens, just kind of got in my mind what things might possibly happen. So I had the emergency things already in my mind, what would go on. And I can't remember when it was, at some point in the first few weeks of winter, I just relaxed. And I was like, what will happen, will happen.
So you were doing mental rehearsals of
something would crop up in my mind to be like, oh yes, what happens if this would happen? And that's just what I'm like. I'm a kind of person that preempts problems, and I'm preemptive rather than reactionary to problems generally. So I'd rather prevent something happening rather than have to deal with the consequences of something happening.
Did the responsibility ever cause you to lose any sleep, or the equivalent of losing sleep?
I think initially it did. I certainly had a bit of trouble sleeping initially, just because I was like, oh gosh. And I think then I realised actually it'd be unsustainable to have that degree of, it wasn't anxious, I think I chatted through with the folks back in the office in the UK, and was just like, they're like, oh, just, it's fine, just, it'll happen. And it was fine. And things do happen when you least expect them to, and you deal with them, and that's what I'm there to do, and I did. So
did you have an emergency at all?
Unfortunately, okay. Can't really say very much about them. But there were things, things happen when you least expected them, and, for minor little things that aren't that, significant, things that, quite challenging, and it really would be when you least expect it to. So you always had, always have your radio with you and just deal with it. And I think after the first time when that happened, it was like, doctor, can you come to this place? I think after that first time of that happening as an emergency, and I think it was quite early on in winter, and you realise that you do, just there's a switch that takes you into that, and you just deal with it. And as soon as that first time of it happened and I dealt with it, I was then much more comfortable with it. I knew that I could just deal with whatever came, and I was fine.
Do I remember you saying you had to make a decision about medevacing somebody out?
We never, as the doctors on the floor, we never directly make the decision about medevacing somebody out. We kind of impart that knowledge to us, the doctors back in Basmus. It's the consultants' decisions that make those decisions. So we kind of are merely sort of vehicles in the pathway, so to speak. Although obviously our clinical acumen and decisions...
Well, you're like a kind of interpreter, really, aren't you?
And seeing what's going on the shop floor, because obviously you can't see the patient directly in front of them.
So somebody was evacuated at some point? Sorry, you haven't got to answer that question. Sorry, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I'm trying to get to you how you felt about all that, having to do that.
Oh, it didn't bother me at all. I mean, that's the job I'm there to do. And, as far as I see the role of the doctor being in Antarctica, you're there as a rather a large insurance policy, because, you're there to deal with what can be dealt with locally and to inform accurately what needs to happen if it does need to go further afield. And we certainly managed, if you hadn't had a doctor there, there'd certainly be so many more people flying back and forth unnecessarily for medevacs or whatever than having had one there, which is... obviously a good thing, because it shows that we're doing our job correctly. But I never felt uncomfortable if I had some due way. It's never a decision that's made lightly. Every single time that decision is made with the patient's best interest at heart. And it's never a decision that's made it's a very considered decision.
There are stories in the old days not necessarily the very old days, but of doctors having to weigh up the condition of the patient against the dangers that might be experienced by other people trying to get them out.
Yeah, fortunately we were never in that position, so I never had to try and medevac anybody in the middle of winter.
Right.
So I was fortunate insofar that wherever I had to do anything to extricate a patient, it was always during summer, the weather was always fine. I didn't have to weigh up any pros and cons of risk to anybody else. So that was fine. And I was always fortunate in a way that the flights always seemed to be timely or useful if I ever had to send anybody out.
Okay. let's move on to other things then, because I'm conscious of the boundaries. Although I wouldn't want to stop, don't want to stop you from telling me something if you think it's appropriate.
Yeah.
You were doing some medical research, as is the tradition with doctors in the Antarctic, because you haven't got an awful lot of GP work to do. There's time to do other things.
Yeah. So, well, part of it was, it's part of doing the Masters in Remote Healthcare that we do through the Peninsula Medical School down in Plymouth, which is now running the kind of Masters programme for doctors going to Antarctica. And it was actually a really good course. And part of it, part of what I did was a research project. And I designed a research project looking at swine flu, because just before I went away, there was a swine flu epidemic in, well, worldwide. Was he being an epidemic? And so it was quite pertinent. And I basically ran a study by taking throat swabs from everybody that arrived at Rothera, or trying to get everybody that arrived at Rothera, and then following a weekly cohort as well to see whether we actually got swine flu, and if we did, whether there was anything being passed around between people. And then people kept diaries of who they were in contact with. And managed to get my swabs back to the UK, and that, I remember being in Antarctica, I managed to get them back from Antarctica to Cambridge without any problem at all. They had to be stowed at minus 80 degrees centigrade.
Minus 80?
Yeah, to kind of prevent a replication of the viruses. And they had the most ridiculous challenge you could possibly imagine to get them from Cambridge to Bristol to the Health Protection Agency. It was one of the most difficult things to organise ever. It was just trying to organise a flight to the moon would have been easier probably. I managed it eventually.
Well, so tell me a bit more about that.
It's just the way logistics of transporting samples from non-hospitals. If I could have got to Cambridge to drive them myself, it would have been fine. Unfortunately, I was in Antarctica at the time, in the middle of winter. It wasn't so easy. But I did manage to get them there.
But you had to get a mobile fridge, did you, to get them from...
It was more to do with getting a carrier who has licences to carry viral samples. Yes, and health and safety things. But anyway, they've gone there. Unfortunately, there has been another epidemic since, and so they still haven't assayed my samples.
Oh.
So I'm waiting for the results of that still. But fortunately, the professor who I was liaising with, I'm actually going to be at the university he is now, or he's a professor at, from October. So fingers crossed I can get my samples assayed over the summer and have a useful cohort of data to use come the autumn and actually write it up.
Were you able to do any analysis in the Antarctic? Was it all just simply taking the swabs and parceling them up?
It's taking the swabs and parceling them up, and then also doing a bit of analysis of the diary data, because I can't do anything with the swab data until I've actually got the results from the swabs. And had a sort of brief look at the diary data, but it's a bit difficult to interpret without the swab results, so it's rather a work in progress. But the other parts of the Masters have been very useful. So we did a leadership module as well, which was in the middle of winter, which was really nice to have something gritty to get your teeth into, and seemed rather pertinent as well, sort of in an area where Antarctica is a place renowned for what for leaders and examples of leadership. So to be doing that and studying leadership during that period was quite useful. So yeah, it was quite interesting.
Just going back to the swine flu, I mean, were you aware, as a sort of casual observation, of people going becoming ill in the Antarctic or...?
We were certainly very keen to prevent swine flu arriving, so we prevented any tourist ships coming in. So there were no unnecessary visits last year, in my first summer. And we were very cautious with hand washing. And if anybody became poorly, we isolated in their rooms. And you had a greater awareness of it. And I think to an extent you have to have that anyway in a small isolated community, but because of the severity of the swine flu going around, we had to be even more so. And the people did become poorly with flus and things, but we don't know. And we kind of, some people who developed a cold or a flu, for example, en route down were being held in Falklands for 5 days as a protest measure. So, I mean, it did have an operational effect subsequently, and that may well be what I was delayed, to be honest, going in, because other people had been stuck in the Falklands for a week or something while one of their compatriots had the flu.
So there was a genuine concern there, apart from doing the medical research to see what was happening. Was there a genuine concern this illness could sweep through Rothera.
Yeah. And if it did, it would have had, if it, not knowing how virulent it could be with any illness, though, that could sort of through that environment. You know, if you lose certain, there's almost, you need a sort of certain basic cohort number of people to keep a base running. And if those people become really, really poorly, lots of them simultaneously, it would have a great knock-on effect for operationally how much they could achieve.
And the temperatures weren't cold enough to either kill off the bug or make them dormant?
No, because the built temperatures inside the buildings were probably warmer than my house.
I'm sure you're right.
Slightly Baltic, sorry. Do you want a jumper? Yeah, I think I've never been warmer in my life than I have in Antarctica. I'm used to being in a house where putting on more jumpers and clothes is necessary. So
how was it? I mean, I was going to come to that later, but let's do it now. I mean, the way that the environment, the internal environment at the Antarctic is managed, was it comfortable or was it overbearing?
No, it was lovely, actually. And for me, it was very familiar because particularly the accommodation block where we were living is Swedish built. And having lived in Sweden a bit, the fixtures and fittings were, you know, even down, yeah, it was basically very like living back in my flat in Sweden. So that was really nice. And familiarity from both Sweden and Canada, where you have boot rooms, because obviously you're wearing so much outdoor paraphernalia. You have a specific room for your outdoor clothes, and then you change it in, you know, put on your slippers and go through. So that's quite kind of commonplace. And I kind of go to coming back, I'm like, oh, where's the boot room? you realise actually it's quite a useful facility to have. So, no, the environment was really comfortable. The rooms were, we had sort of, for the people who are wintering, and most of the summer staff could fit into Admiral's House, which is a room, a long building with twin, I think it's got 42 twin rooms, sort of bunk beds with ensuite showers. It's a real luxury because I had, you know, no idea what to expect. And you look at the photos online, which are pretty out of date, and you've got these bunk rooms with four people to a room and no bathroom and no windows. So yeah, it's beautiful. Really comfortable, actually, much more than I had anticipated. But not so comfortable that it's that we're spoiling our people. So they don't need to make it nasty. We're not wasting taxpayers' money. And the heat, it's got quite intelligent heating, and they can actually control it from Cambridge or something, I've heard. I don't understand. But no, you could open the windows if you want to. If it's too hot, you can turn your radiators off. If it's too cold, it's, you know, it's not dictated to you how you have to have your rooms. And then the communal buildings, sort of old and new Bransfield, are really comfortable. You can kind of, you know, everybody during winter kind of gravitated to all their places where they kind of preferred to be. So nobody had their specific seat, but people kind of congregated in different areas, which was nice to kind of make it more homely.
Well, you were down to, is it 9 people in the winter? Is
that right? 22.
22, I was, yeah, 9 at Halley. Sorry.
Yeah, 9 at Halley, 22 at, which is comparatively large.
Yeah. Tell me about the shift in atmosphere and everything between once the summer people had flown.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Well, it was funny because the first week I literally went on to nights.
So you were on Firewatch, were you?
Yeah, I was on Firewatch, which I didn't really enjoy. It's quite a lonely task. I used to really enjoy nights as a doctor because it's quite sociable and there's lots of people around. And it's a different kind of atmosphere, whereas on Nightwatch in Antarctica, you're on your own. It's quite scary. You're going around this. I know there's no need to be scared, but I haven't even watched the scary films like The Thing, but... But yeah, I got nervous. You know, it's quite scary going around on your own, this quite large Antarctic base with your torch and doing all the daily, nightly checks. So, anyways, that happened when there was this transition from summer into winter. So, I don't think I kind of visualized, I didn't experience so much the change. It was because I was asleep during the daytimes. But there definitely was a sort of gear shift. And people started to go out on their winter trips that first week. So it was only during, I think, just before midwinter that everybody was all together again, which is a bit of a shame because it would have been actually nicer had we had at least had a week where we were all together. Because I think within the first week, there were 6 people away. I was on nights. So it was a real change.
And these were recreational trips or...?
These are winter training trips, so they're not so much recreational. They, you know, it's not just so you can go and not do your work. It's so that if the base were to burn down, that you'd be able to cope living in a pyramid tent, you'd be competent at using the primer stoves, tilly lamps, and actually be able to survive for at least a week, because you may have to survive for longer if the base burned down.
It has happened in the past, yeah. Did he feel lonely?
Yeah.
Not necessarily just at night, but at any other time.
Yeah, no, I did. I think the time when I first really noticed it, that you were kind of at the end of the world, was the time we were all sitting up in the tower on Midwinter's Day listening to the Midwinter broadcast. And he just looked around and I was like, my gosh, look, there's the 22 of us in this one room. There's nobody around for thousands of miles. We're at the end of the world and nobody can get in or out. Nobody's coming till November. Well, at that time we thought October. And it was like, gosh, like a real reminder, because it felt, because to an extent, you know, with the internet and things and the telephones, you can easily forget you're at the opposite end of the world. but that really brought home the kind of, no, we really are. And yeah, no, it was lonely. And there were, it was a really quite a good, you know, it was a good group of, had a very good group of friends during the summer. A good group of girlfriends. And I missed having good girlfriends during winter. Which was hard. I don't know whether the other girls felt it. I did try. But no, it did feel lonely. But then, you know...
How many girls were there for the winter?
There were four girls in total.
Four women.
Four women. Sorry, I probably said girls. Women.
No, it's okay. Sorry.
I'd rather be a girl than a woman. but no, it did feel lonely. And people joke about me for spending so much time on the phone. But I think it made me really value how very lucky I am with my friends back at home. And made me also realise sometimes I'd taken them for granted. So I think I was trying to, not that you can really make it, you know, amends for that, or not trying to make amends, but was, you know, making an effort to make sure I didn't lose those friendships whilst I was away. So yeah, so people are always joking about the phone glued to my ear, but it was very important for me to have good support from friends.
You had complete free access to the phone?
Yes, you can... we had VoIP phones, so they're internet phones,
right.
So people can phone back in, and it's just like phoning a Cambridge number, which is great. A really valued resource. Had it been at the time when you had 400 words a month, I don't know, actually, I think if you had been at the time with 400 words a month, I think people would have spent a greater degree of time altogether, actually, because in the library they have all these workbooks of kind of project books of previous winters. They've got fun photos of evenings they've made together and jokes and things like that. And I think it's probably since about 2005 or something. There haven't been any more of those. And it may be that because of the internet, because of Facebook, because of the VoIP phones, there's no one can actually look externally to their immediate social media rather than having to just liaise with those people. Because if you're limited to 400 words a month, well, that's not a great deal of conversation to have with anybody in the outside world. You've got to get on with those people. And maybe to an extent, the advent of more information going back and forth, you lose that a bit. I don't know.
You lose the isolation.
You lose the need for that cohesive force, I think. Having said which, I mean, don't get me wrong, I made some very good friends as well. I've even been across to see Smiler this afternoon, so that was lovely. And the friendships you develop... Sometimes it's funny, the people you become very good friends with might be the people you didn't expect to, or might be the people you had a kind of tiff with about something, and then you realise, oh, actually, no, that's fine. So that's actually quite nice. And I'm looking forward to meeting up with them again as well. So I think there's definitely a sort of element of a bond that you're always going to share.
I appreciate you trying to keep up with medical science whilst you're away, but did you lose any interest? Did you lose interest in what was happening in the rest of the world?
No, I definitely didn't. Some people, I think there were a couple of people I went who never ever checked BBC News website. But for me, maybe I should have taken advantage of the fact that I didn't have to be aware of what's going on in the world. That maybe it's because I was feeling isolated. I actually had a bit of a routine in the morning, go and check my emails, check BBC News World, see what's going on. Could be also related to the leadership, actually, Masters, because we had to be aware of and abreast of decisions. And also there's been some mammoth changes going on in the NHS.
Mm.
Which for me has been particularly interesting, and many a time when people have come in family ranting at the computer. I felt a need to probably be more in contact with the outside world, even looking at local news, which I probably haven't really done at all since I've been home. But
what, the Durrington Village Fete?
No, well, yeah, just looking on BBC News and looking at Hampshire and Wiltshire and seeing what's going on. And sometimes it's absolutely shocking. I mean, looking at the BBC News website, it's actually on the main page, and there was a tragic, a father shot his family in Fordingbridge, where I'd worked as a doctor, just around the corner from the surgery. And, you know, it's just like, gosh, you know, that was quite hard. So
some of the fit had talked about feeling impotent about the world. There was, they hear news from the rest of the world, perhaps some family news, and there's nothing they can do because they're so far away.
I don't know whether that's changed because maybe of communications a bit now, I don't know. But even...
Well, it may have made it worse. I mean, yeah, 30 or 40 years ago, they didn't know what was happening.
No. And I suppose that that's in some respects better. If you do know, however, to be able to actually speak to the people or be able to, you know, order flowers online or something to arrive at someone's house or little things like that you do for people. Hmm. I mean, I certainly ordered some birthday presents and things while I was away over the internet for Christmas and things like that. I think it actually helps in those situations. I was very lucky that nothing bad happened to my family when I was away. I don't know how I would have found it very difficult had it happened. I was lucky not to be in that situation.
So there was no panic attacks or no, oh my God, I want to go home. None of that.
No, there were definitely times when I felt low and there were definitely times that were challenging, but I never thought it was going to be a feel, you know, I didn't think it was going to be a fate. You know, you don't go to the opposite side of the world to go to Antarctica and think every day is going to be really easy because, well, you wouldn't want to do it if it was, would you? I mean, I wouldn't. It's useful to have challenges and you certainly learn from them. And I've learned a lot. And probably from things I would never have anticipated ever learning. I wouldn't have, some of the things I've gleaned and learnt, I never thought Antarctica would be the place I'd learn them. Actually, they probably didn't figure on my radar of things I might learn ever. So, not just skills, but kind of, you know, awareness of things. So, yeah, but there were times when it was hard. I think I said to my mum and sister the other day, I was, oh, you know, I might go back to Antarctica. No, you can't do that. It was really hard. I was like, oh, why? He's like, oh, they're worried about you. Maybe they were, obviously they were worried. I think mummy actually sent a text message or an email rather saying, I think it's my last month. Please, Claire, make sure you come home safely. Don't do anything silly in the last month. And, you know, purposefully, like during winter, I skied as sedately as I could. And, you know, desperate not to injure myself. Hopefully not at the expense of having fun. I still enjoyed my skiing. But I definitely kind of, the last week, I was like, well, maybe I could try going a little bit harder. And I did push myself a bit, but I wasn't going to think I was going to really injure myself.
So you had that responsibility of not becoming hurt, not becoming a patient.
Yeah.
Yourself.
Yeah. That's not because I don't trust the doctor who was there to look after me. I just, particularly, during winter, there wasn't a doctor to look after me. So there was that one. And even during summer, there's ideally an operational need to have two doctors. You don't want to create work for somebody else to then have to ship you out.
Maybe back yourself.
No, exactly. Hello, I'd like a taxi, please. Yes, a dash seven to Rotherham. Yeah.
Let's pause for a minute, okay. And we'll come back and do some more.
Well, okay. Then.